You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We bring expertise on international affairs from Stanford's campus straight to you. I'm Chaney Kouroniotis, your host and the communications director here at FSI. America is divided. By some measures, the country is more polarized than it's been since the Civil War. How did we get here? Do we see a similar trend in other Western democracies? What's the role of political parties in all this? Today, we'll be talking to Dede Kuo. She's a research scholar at FSI's Center on Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law, and she also manages its program on American democracy in comparative perspective. In her work, she explores issues in American politics, such as democratization, corruption, political parties, and political reform. Her most recent research focuses on the decline of political parties in advanced democracies, such as the US and the UK, since the 1970s. She has a new book coming out in August, called Clientelism, Capitalism, and Democracy, The Rise of Programmatic Politics in the United States and Britain. Dede, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chaney. It's great to be here.
And did I pronounce clientelism correctly?
You sure did.
Oh, good.
That was great.
Because I had to practice a few times before we got started.
You got it.
All right. Well, so you and I met in Washington, D.C. a couple of years ago, actually. And we were with Frank Fukuyama, another colleague here at FSI, as he was giving a tour of the Lincoln Memorial to a group of Stanford students and essentially walking our group through and explaining the history and context of the Gettysburg Address.
Right.
And for me, it was early in my days at Freeman Spogli Institute, and I thought it was just a fantastic introduction to the value of the work that FSI does here and around the world. The work that you and Frank and your other colleagues do is both broadly historical and also very urgent. How does it feel right now to be a specialist in political polarization at a time like this?
It feels a little bizarre, I have to say. So we started the program on American democracy and comparative perspective in 2013, when the CDDRL had long been focused on democratization and development, these big processes in many other parts of the world, but we thought it didn't seem perfect either. So why don't we try thinking about how we would apply a comparative lens to American democracy and politics? At the time, we knew that polarization and inequality and distrust in government, all of these things seemed to be getting worse, but I think they've taken on a qualitatively and quantitatively different urgency in 2016, after 2016 with the election of Donald Trump, because you got the rise of populist movements around the world. The rise of far-right parties are doing very well in Western Europe, for example. So it seems like many publics are discontented and that there are these sentiments people have that their democratic institutions don't serve them anymore. And that's been a really interesting thing to work on. But as an academic, sometimes you stay in a world purely of academia, where you're talking about, theories and things that are maybe a little bit obscure. And it's lent a new urgency to how to think about making academic work relevant to the public and to policymakers who might, also be concerned about these things.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's become clearer than ever that political science is an extremely relevant, extremely urgent field for the United States to be looking at right now. So let's break it down a little bit for those of our listeners who are not themselves political scientists. What is comparative American politics? What does that term mean in terms of how you're doing your work?
Great question. So part of this is just sort of academic in the sense that political science as a discipline used to look at politics sort of writ large, like the study of constitutions or democratic systems, and then slowly splintered off into the study only of American politics on the one hand and the study of comparative politics, which was much broader on the other hand, and that encompassed basically every other region of the globe. What we do at our program and what I think increasingly a lot of political scientists are doing are thinking about big things, like if you think about democracy, for example, what are the reasons that some states experience democratic rollback, democratic decline? Alternatively, how do you get democratic renewal? What kind of institutional reforms are necessary to get out of periods of democratic or economic crisis? These are questions that you usually answer by looking at a set of processes in many different contexts to see if there are patterns you can elucidate over time, regardless of the specifics or uniqueness of a political context. So we think that it's useful to look at problems like distrust in democracy or polarization, inequality. These are problems that are not just isolated to the United States. So thinking about how they are unique in some regards because they are American versus how they are common across many advanced democracies helps us disentangle what kind of reform solutions are possible, or, you know, why we need to be talking about these as problems affecting many different countries rather than just us here.
And are there specific cases or particular comparisons that your work has pulled out so far that you think would be especially instructive? Are there other democracies against whom we should be measuring our own progress?
Well, it's that's a good question. So I recently wrote an essay about two sort of styles of comparing the United States. There's one way that I think is becoming increasingly popular, which is to see where the United States ranks in comparison to other countries. For example, the United States is far more unequal than other advanced democracies because we have, well, it's for any number of reasons, but historically we have much smaller of a welfare state than other places. And we typically have less redistributive policy. So as a result, we've gotten high levels of income and economic inequality, particularly after the 1970s. So also Freedom House and Transparency International and The Economist, there are these international organizations that rank democracies according to how well they fulfill different criteria. And they've been finding that the United States is less democratic than other advanced democracies. So that's a useful way to think and to use comparisons. But another thing that's been helpful for us is to look at any number of issues. So we've looked at electoral systems at our program on American democracy. We've looked at lobbying and campaign finance, budgeting policy, policies about the bureaucracy and transparency, and democratic rollback in general in a conference that we hosted with the Central European University in Budapest, where we take one issue like budgeting and ask how other countries do it, how the United States processes do and don't sort of converge with those of other places. And for example, what we found there is that we politicize our budget by passing it through the legislature, while a lot of other countries have economic ministries that draw up a budget and then basically get it approved in an up or down vote by the legislature. So that makes polarization particularly pronounced, because if you have a already polarized legislature, then passing a budget is going to be basically impossible, as it has been in the U.S. And we've had numerous government shutdowns or threats of shutdowns. So those are some ways in which we've found it really useful to be comparative.
So speaking of polarization, right, you've written a number of articles recently on this very issue, polarization in the American democratic system. So I'm thinking here in particularly of the article in The American Interest called The Paradox of Party Polarization, and the Stanford Magazine essay that you wrote called Now What? A Way Out of Our Polarized Politics. So let's talk a little bit about the history of polarization in America. How did it become such a problem? How did we get here?
Great question. So America's unique in having a two-party system. Most other democracies have multiple parties. And because of our two-party system, we've always had some degree of polarization. Obviously, there's going to be issues that parties disagree on. But since the 1970s, there's been a rise in two kinds of polarization. One is just purely between the parties in Congress, for example. They have both become more ideologically cohesive within themselves, so there's less sort of ideological diversity within them. And they've also grown in distance between them. So Republicans have become more conservative, especially as Southerners, Southern Democrats sort of defected to the Republican Party and moved over there. And Democrats have become slightly more liberal, although the movement to the right has been far greater for the Republicans than the concomitant movement to the left for Democrats. But the distance between the two parties has grown. So this means that in Congress, you're much more likely to get split roll call votes of just like pure party line voting. So another way that polarization has worsened is in the public, among people who identify with the Republican or Democratic Party, they display higher levels of antipathy towards members of the other party today than they used to. And there's evidence from Pew, for example, that Republicans are more conservative and that Democrats consider themselves more liberal. And because of this, they're I don't know, there are any number of sort of troubling measures of partisanship within the public. For example, Shanto Iyengar here at Stanford in that same issue of Stanford Magazine has a piece about affective polarization, that people increasingly say that they can't trust someone of the opposite party to do what's in the best interest of the country, or they wouldn't want your child to marry outside their party identification. So for the most part, a lot of Americans feel like they don't like either party. There are more and more people identifying as independents. But among partisans, either in Congress or in the public, you have this growing distance between the parties. And that's typically what polarization refers to.
So it seems like party politics are certainly becoming more and more a salient part of people's personal identities.
That's right.
As much or more than their positions on certain public policy issues.
Exactly. So there's a lot of really good research done on this term affective polarization, that people are mapping their partisan identity onto their social identity. So it's takes the form of just a lot of loyalty and in-group loyalty versus out-group hostility. And it can come into play in employment and in friendship and in all sorts of social decisions that you make about where to live and who to interact with.
Right. And that where to live part, I think, also is quite striking. As the U.S. becomes more mobile over the generations, it's become easier and easier to sort ourselves into geographic regions by sociopolitical identity.
That's right. So there's a lot of evidence that, you know, I mean, if you look, for example, at just the distribution of votes for Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, you have increasingly dense places, particularly on the coasts and in cities, where Democrats are likely to live or where people are likely to be liberal. And then you have these other spaces, suburban spaces, rural areas that are very Republican. And that has enormous consequences when you have that kind of geographic division, because the elections to the House and to the Senate are based on geography. So you have a Senate that is more Republican than Democratic, even though there are many more people, 39 million, who live in California than the 500,000 who live in Wyoming, but we each have two senators. And then in the House of Representatives, there have been many elections to the House where Democrats win millions of more votes in the aggregate, but Republicans retain a big advantage in terms of the number of seats they hold.
Simply due to the structure of the way we're counting votes.
Right, and where people – where those votes are allocated geographically.
Mm-hmm. Right. So let's bring a discussion of capitalism into this as well, because when I think of democracy and capitalism in America, I have a hard time separating the two.
That's right.
In particular, one of the things you talk about in your book is the relationship between capitalism and political development historically, right? So the question of patronage, the question of clientelism. How did that become a strategy in the 19th century, and what are sort of the reverberations of that today?
So in the 19th century, part of the inspiration of the book was to try to think about how party systems have changed over time. So we used to have in the 19th century a party system based entirely on patronage. Like in 1828, Andrew Jackson famously instituted the spoils system. So if you voted for a party, they would give you a job, for example, in the postal service or in a customs house. And there was a lot of bribery in elections, you know, these different ways of mobilizing voters. In the late 19th century, the book argues that you got this new rise of merchants and manufacturers because of processes of industrialization and a lot of changes in capitalism that led to some changes within capitalism itself. For example, you got the rise of a corporation that was centrally managed through a hierarchy based on merit, and you got the rise of sort of a set of businessmen, at the time most of them were men, who really thought patronage was an ineffective way to govern. It was very costly. There was a lot of evidence that politicians didn't really like it. And President Garfield famously was assassinated by someone who, well, he was at least shot. There's a technical debate about what he actually died of. But he was shot by someone who thought he was promised a position in a New York customs house that he didn't receive. So patronage seemed like a good way for parties to win votes. They funded their activities through patronage. If you had a patronage job, you had to give part of your income back to the party. You had to volunteer during campaigns. But there was a lot of movement and lobbying on the part of the business community to create more stable and effective government institutions. And in fact, in the 1880s, there was really a period of institutional reform when the federal government passed the Pendleton Act that created merit-based hiring in the civil service. They passed the first regulatory commission, the Interstate Commerce Commission, to regulate railway pricing. So in the 19th century, it was the Gilded Age. You had huge companies, railways, U.S. Steel, that were monopolistic and corrupt, and they were very discriminatory in their pricing, for example. They had a lot of policies that were very unfavorable to citizens, farmers, laborers, and also to this big class of merchants and manufacturers. And my argument is just that there are times in capitalist development when capitalists have needed the state to help sort of stabilize the economy and create more effective institutions. And if you actually carry that forward to today, in the post-war period, like after the 1940s, you also got the rise of sort of a great, you know, time of economic growth in American corporations and American capitalism. John Kenneth Galbraith famously said that American capitalism worked through a system of countervailing power where big corporations, big business had to answer to big government and big labor. And there's a lot of really cool historical work about the way that businesses tried to lobby for infrastructure. They got on board with any number of social welfare provisions and regulation. Whereas you have a big shift after the 1970s, you get the rise of sort of new forms of capitalism, much more global and financial capital, a shift from sort of stakeholder or managerial capitalism to instead shareholder capitalism, this idea that the only thing that matters is the bottom line, the profits that you're making for the shareholders. And ever since then, you've had a big divergence. So there is a lot of evidence now that, for example, there's a link between polarization and inequality because parties generally answer to the interests of the affluent and the wealthy. There's just a lot of empirical social science about this. And typically in the past few decades, what the wealthy, even though that's an amorphous term, have wanted are, you know, lower taxes, especially lower corporate taxes. They want greater free trade, more globalization. And I think the candidacies of Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders really showed that people have been displaced by these kinds of economic policies and feel pretty aggrieved or pretty upset about it. But it's very difficult to pinpoint blame when it seems like all politicians want the same thing. You know, there's been this general acceptance of a neoliberal economic agenda since the 1980s, continuing through Clinton and honestly even through Obama. So voters, I think a lot of times are expressing anger or discontent with the political system when really they're also very upset with a set of economic policies that they feel has not benefited them, or they feel that the government hasn't responded to the ways that they've been displaced by it.
Right. Okay. And let's close out the show here by talking a little bit more about that particular issue. Right. So there's been a lot of discussion, I think, in the public sphere lately about increased dissatisfaction with democracy as a system of governance, especially right. among younger citizens, younger voters. Right. Poll after poll and study after study shows a declining support for democracy.
Right.
In a lot of highly developed Western democracies. But I wonder, especially, I think this is something you have addressed in this work and also have a forthcoming article about, whether that dissatisfaction is as much or more about capitalism as it is about democracy itself, and whether specifically American voters really have enough information to tell the difference between the two, or whether there's so little daylight in our system between capitalism and democracy that it's impossible to tease them apart.
Right. So, I mean, unlike democracy, which has always had a very clear alternative in the form of authoritarianism, capitalism, the alternative to it, like a state-controlled, for example, communist command economy, seems pretty laughable. You know, basically all countries today, even ostensibly communist ones like China, embrace some market-based or somewhat capitalist type of economy. So I think it's really difficult to think in terms of an alternative economic system. And it's even difficult to think of, you know, pinpointing blame on an economic system, because you're right, Cheney, it's hard to think of how we would change it. And typically the way that governments have managed problems of capitalism is through public policy. They create more redistributive policy or progressive taxation or social safety net policies that help people who might be displaced through economic policies. So I do think that the a lot of young voters have grown up in a time in which our nation, for example, has been at war for like well over a decade. And also we suffered a huge recession in 2008, and the effects of those are still being felt. So they have a lot of insecurity. It's the first generation that might be downwardly mobile. And there are any number of guarantees that former generations felt they had by living in the United States that doesn't seem available to young voters, especially as they are heavily in debt if they decide to go to college or they take part in this gig economy that seems to be on the rise. There's also the threat of automation, the threat of AI that has sort of untold consequences for employment in the future. So I think that in a time of real uncertainty, people feel angry. And given that there's very little alternative to embrace, you know, I think the reason that there's all this democratic decline stuff is because you can ask people, you know, do you think a military president is a, or having the military step in and intervene sometimes in national politics is a good idea? Or do you think authoritarianism can sometimes be better than democracy? Those are clear questions to ask. But it's really difficult to ask about alternatives to capitalism and what people want. I mean, we do have examples of like Bernie Sanders running as a democratic socialist, but socialism doesn't really have a long history in the United States. It's not very clear what that would mean in terms of policy. So yes, I do think that there is a backlash now among voters, both to their system of government and to the economic opportunities available to them.
Right. Well, it sounds like there is going to be continued need for this type of comparative work, both in terms of historical comparison and global contemporary comparison, if we're to keep the system functioning in a way that works for everyone. So Didi Kuo, thanks so much for joining us on World Class. The new book coming out in August is called Clientelism, Capitalism, and Democracy: The Rise of Programmatic Politics in the United States and Britain. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thanks, Janie.
You've been listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. If you like this episode, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps other people find the show. And be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on what's happening in the world and why.